News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II. The idea is really threefold. First of all, we want to honor their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for posterity, and along the way, learn a thing or two, be inspired by our greatest generation. We do that each week, and occasionally when I'm out of town covering sports, I catch up with veterans outside of the San Joaquin Valley. That's the case today. I'm at the beautiful sprawling grounds of the California Veterans Home in Yountville. Fresno will be getting a veterans home soon, and we're going to hear a little bit about how this original California Veterans Home, been here since 1884, works for our veterans today. Going to visit with Bob Heiss, 89 years old, originally from San Francisco. And Bob, I'll ask you about the Veterans Home a little bit later on, but I want to ask you about your 19th birthday, because your 19th birthday was a lot different than everybody else's. In fact, I ask every guest on this show about your 19th birthday, because that was December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day and your unique experiences on it?
Well, being my birthday, I was at home with my family. I had already started to work as a civilian at McClellan Air Force Base in Sacramento, and we went back to San Francisco. I had a double date with a friend of mine, and we went to the Palace Hotel, dinner dancing. He gave his girlfriend a ring that night. So it was an exciting evening. Mm-hmm. The next morning, my father woke me up and said that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. And a little bit later on in the morning, they announced on the radio that all employees of government facilities should report back to their duty stations. So Dan and I went back to Sacramento and got to work about 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon. We didn't leave until about 5 o'clock Monday afternoon, more than 24 hours. I was in electric shop, aircraft electrician, and since most of the guns are fired with an electrical connection of some sort, the electric shop got the job of putting machine guns on aircraft. Up until that time, as I said, we had never seen a machine gun on an aircraft. So it did that for more than 24 hours. In the meantime, they were painting all the windows black, went into a war mode very rapidly. So that was my birthday. I was, last half of that day, I was working.
I can't imagine how big of a shock to the system that was, because obviously you knew something was going on in the world, and the whole reason that the military had all these planes was that they might need to use them sometime. But it seemed like things really changed for you. It intensified. And did you have a concept of how huge this was going to be and how massive this effort was?
No, not at all. That when that war started, it was because we were attacked. So everybody really rallied around to get things done. And the war effort really got underway, I think, very rapidly. Everybody went to work in factories, in shipyards, building either airplanes or ships or munition factories. Automobile production was stopped totally, and they turned into building tanks or other military vehicles. I expected, naturally, to be drafted. I tried to enlist in the Navy and the Marine Corps, but I couldn't pass their eye examination. You couldn't wear glasses at that time and still get accepted. Later on, things changed. By the spring of 1943, I expected to get a draft notice anytime, because I had gotten one deferment working in a military installation. They came around and asked for volunteers at McClellan for immediate overseas duty. Well, when they said immediate, we said, yeah, okay. But at least we thought we'll volunteer and we'll still be in the Army Air Corps. Didn't become the separate unit of the Air Force, you know, until 1948.
Right.
But at any rate, a number of us volunteered. In fact, there was about 250 men from McClellan eventually that volunteered for this program. We were sent down to Kelly Air Base in San Antonio, Texas, mm-hmm. for our basic training. We went in the service on the 19th of June. On the 19th of July, we were back on a train leaving Kelly. We had completed everything that we were going to, all the training we were ever going to get in the military on our way overseas. So earlier when they said immediate overseas assignment, they meant that. It wound up that there was a cadre of around 2,000 men that opened up a major overhaul base in England at Burtonwood. A little town of Warrington was our closest town, about halfway between Manchester and Liverpool. And so I was there for a little over 2 years. During that two-year period, our work schedule was almost always 10 hours a day. If we got rushed, it went to 12 hours a day. And the plant was open 7 days a week. At first, we would get 1 day off every eighth day. And then they figured out, well, if we work these guys about 2 weeks straight, we'll give them 2 days off, which was better, a little bit more rest that way. So that's what most of our schedule was. In the 2 years, I had three-day passes. What you kind of did, you said, well, Chief, how about if I take my 2 days off, and then, you know, 2 weeks later, I won't take two, I'll only take one, and that's kind of the way you worked it. Mm-hmm. So we saw a little bit of England, but not a great deal.
Getting back to right after Pearl Harbor, you mentioned something. You mentioned blacking out the windows. Now, your family's in San Francisco. There was a lot of fear at the time around San Francisco and all up the coast of California of the Japanese attacking the coast. What was it like for your family, and were you concerned about them being right there in San Francisco, which seemed to a lot of civilians as a pretty potential target?
Yes, it was a potential target, and they went through blackout conditions as well. Kept their shades closed at night, didn't have any outside lights on, all of that sort of thing. The same thing that was going on when we were in England. But in England, it was even more blackout than it had been in San Francisco. Yes, there was concern, because at times we had heard that there was a submarine spotted off the coast and various things like that, Japanese submarine. So there was concern for our families that were living on the coast. You're absolutely right.
And what was it like being 21 years old and halfway around the world from your family or anybody that you'd ever spent much time with? Because I imagine in 30 days of training, you don't make too many great friends.
Well, other than the fact that we were with other men who we knew at McClellan. Well, you wound up in a little squad or a little platoon that you were kind of with all through the 30 days of training, really less than that because there was transportation time in between there. So the eight or so fellows you were with in your basic, you got to know them pretty well. But when we got to England, then we were pretty well separated out again because one man might be an engine mechanic, somebody else an instrument mechanic, somebody else a propeller mechanic. So they went to their various shops. But then you made new friends. We lived in what was commonly called a Quonset hut, or the English actually called them Nissan huts. That always sounded Japanese to me. I never quite understood that. And I almost hate to tell you what they were made of. They were made of asbestos, corrugated asbestos. And of course, the Nissan hat is like a half dome, and with a smooth layer of asbestos inside. As a result, they stayed fairly warm. We had a little, I was going to say a pot stove, but more like a chimney stove in the middle of the barracks that we burned coke. And, well, a couple little incidents. It wasn't all work. We managed to joke around a little bit. When we were first there, we were restricted to the base. Excepting opening up this base, we had no chaplain, we had no cooks, we had none of the services you'd normally find. Well, you know, GIs are very ingenious. They find all kinds of ways to do things. So the fellows would go to the CO and they'd say, can I have a pass to go to the chapel house? Yes, you can have a pass to go to the chapel house. But he began getting suspicious when half the camp wanted to go to the chapel house. This doesn't sound right. So he followed some of the fellows one evening, and they were telling the truth. They were going to the chapel house, except that was the name of a pub in the little village of Sankey. So we weren't, you know, misstating anything. But after that, he kind of changed and says, guys, let's say the whole word. The chapel house is a pub. If you want to go there, fine. Just don't pull my leg anymore. That was one little incident. Another problem we had when early on was laundry. Laundry went out every Tuesday and came back on Thursday, not 2 days later, but 10 days later. Well, you're issued two of everything. So what does that mean? That means you've got one set in the laundry and you're wearing one set. You have to wait till that set gets back so you can really send your laundry out every 2 weeks. That's a little bit long, so a lot of us wrote home, said, Mom, or your wife, whatever, need some more underwear because we just don't have enough. Fortunately, we were issued long johns as well as summer wear. And in England, we found that we wore the long johns probably 6 straight months out of the year. It was fairly cool coming from California, where we're used to warmer weather. In fact, it was so cool that when they'd run aircraft into the hangar in the wintertime, if we'd had some snow and there was snow on top of the wings, by the time we ran the aircraft back out of the hangar, 24 hours later, that snow was still there. So the temperature in the hangars, we had no heat in them, would be the same as the outside temperature. One of the other things that we did to get around the laundry problem I mentioned, some of the fellows says, we think we could make a washing machine. We're all mechanics. We have sheet metal men. We have electricians. We have all this. Well, on B-17s and B-24s, they both had an inverter that converted the 24-volt DC to 220-volt AC. That's great because the British current was 220 volts. We made motors out of the inverters and to drive the washing machine. So when we tried to move this contraption back to our living quarters, one of the fellows managed to get a truck somehow, a 6x. We got to the gate and the guard says, "What have you got back there?" Oh, he said, "You can't take anything away from the hangars. You got, yeah, I can't let you through." I thought, okay. So about a week later, we did it again. Only this time we threw a tarp over the washing machine. The fellows had sidearms on and said, when they got the gate, said, "Classified material." Guard said, "Go ahead." So we got by with that. Well, it was shortly after that, though, that our laundry service improved and we got laundry back in 5 days. So we didn't have quite the problem. But along with working the 10 hours or 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, we did manage to have a little fun sometimes. In general, the base where we were assigned, it was wound up with some 20,000 men. We overhauled engines, instruments, everything that the Air Force was using at that time. We had all the skills necessary to do all of that work. And I might just say that the base was open from, originally opened in 1942. It was a British base, but we had some American people there as technicians to kind of guide them in the repair of B-17s. We always had American aircraft there. That base did not close until 1992, some 50 years later. We have a Burtonwood Association that we still meet once a year. And in as much as we had people all those years, some of the, I'll say, younger fellows are taking over now, running the association. I have not been to one of the meetings for about 2 years now, but I get their correspondence all the time. Keep in touch with some of the fellows.
I want to hear more about this washing machine, because I don't think I've ever heard about a washing machine built out of parts from American bombers. Anybody put in for a patent for that, and did it actually work?
Oh yes, it worked. We didn't really make it out of parts. We had lots of sheet metal and extrusion and things like that to make things. We could build most anything. But the fellows, they're very talented, and they were all mechanics before we went in, so there was no training period necessary to teach us how to be mechanics or electricians or instrument men or whatever the given task was. At other times, we would have shows come there. We did not get any of the big shows until after D-Day because there was a build-up all during those years, and there was just, well, I don't know, I suppose somewhere near 1 million men in southern England scattered all around, and most of the name shows would go there. At one time, we did have Bob Hope there. We had Glenn Miller there. Probably the last performance that Glenn Miller made before he was lost at sea. He left England flying over to France, and his band went a different, and I don't care if it was another aircraft or went by ship. They got there, and he didn't, which was a great loss. I might mention when D-Day came along, one of the things that had been kept very secret until it actually happened. Somebody, somewhere along the line, must have ordered millions of gallons of white paint and black paint. And you've probably seen pictures of World War II, the time of the invasion. All of our aircraft had black and white stripes on the wings and the fuselage. They were about, I guess, a foot wide, and it was 3-4 stripes there. So they were readily identifiable. by our troops to know that, yes, those are our aircraft. So everything got painted, and that happened practically overnight. So where all the paint came from, somebody was thinking ahead on that one.
Was that an all-hands-on-deck situation to get those painted? Were you guys all called out of whatever else you were doing to paint them, or was that a specific task of some painters?
Well, that happened mostly in the operating squadrons. All of a sudden, aircraft showed up at our place that were painted. If we did any of the painting, I'm not aware of it at our base because we were the major overhaul. But it was the operating squadrons that all managed to get their aircraft painted because nothing went out on the 6th of June that wasn't painted.
Well, it's about time for our first commercial break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about some of those shows that Bob witnessed back during World War II. We'll talk also about the aircraft he worked on and some of the things that stick with him still today, all these years later. We'll also find out what it's like to live at the California Veterans Home in Yountville, where this program originates today. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and Advanced Placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
String of Pearls, of course, from the late, great Glenn Miller. And our guest today, Bob Heiss, got to see a Glenn Miller show, perhaps the last Glenn Miller show for the troops overseas before that great musician was lost in his airplane. Of course, maybe you've seen that famous movie that details those experiences. Bob, I want to ask you what it was like for you and all these young servicemen who were working these long days that you talked about. You know, you go work 2 weeks at a time, then get 2 days off. To have some guy you've heard of, Bob Hope or Glenn Miller, come and perform for the troops, how big of a deal was that? And did it really do what it was supposed to do? Did it change the morale of the guys around that base?
Oh, it absolutely changed the morale. What we would do is one of the larger hangars would clear out all the aircraft and put up a makeshift stage out of, we used engine boxes, because an engine box was about 4x4x4, so you put a bunch of those together and you have a stage of sorts, so everybody could crowd into one of the hangars. And yes, it was very much appreciated. We always enjoyed having folks from home. I won't say it was a totally lonely experience, but it was an experience that I'm here and they're there. I don't know if anybody's talked to you about V-mail. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you do it on a 8x11 piece of paper, then it gets photographed, shrunk down into microfilm, and then it's printed out. But when it's printed out, it's no longer a full sheet. It's only about 5x7, something like that. Mm-hmm. So if they write small, it's really small when you get it. And it never seemed like it was something personal. Here was this kind of form piece of paper with something printed on it. It was no longer your parents or your girlfriend's handwriting. So, but we did. We appreciated those shows very much, and we were probably as raucous as anybody when cheering on and clapping and applauding. We really liked them.
You mentioned getting mail from home, from family or from a girlfriend. Did you leave a special someone back home when you went overseas?
Well, yes, I did. But as happened to many other fellows, at some point along the line, I got a Dear John letter. Mm-hmm. I've met a sailor. That could have been anybody else, but here I am in the Air Force, and she met a sailor. That just...
So if she would have sent you a Dear John letter and said it was another Army Air Corps guy, you would have been okay. But a sailor, then you were hopping mad.
That just kind of did me in there.
I want to hear about some of the work you did on this base, because all kinds of different aircraft. And it occurs to me that if you have a major overhaul base like this, where a lot of the weapons of war are being serviced and refurbished and getting ready to go attack again, that you guys might be considered a potential target for the enemy. Were you ever targeted? Were you ever having to dodge bombs or strafing or anything like that? And was that a fear in the back of your mind?
Yes, that's always a thought you have. But we always said they picked out the foggiest place in all of England to put this base. We didn't think the Germans would be able to find it. Actually, the record shows that we were attacked twice. I don't recall either time that we were attacked. I do remember air raid sirens went off a few times, but I never actually heard anything exploding or anything. But as I mentioned earlier, we have an association and they print a magazine monthly. And just recently, it mentioned that fact that it did get attacked twice. I don't personally remember it. I do remember an attack while I was in London on one of the three-day passes that I got. That's an interesting little side story as well. I went down to London actually to see a friend of mine who had been very seriously injured in an airplane crash, a fellow I grew up with, and he was a pilot. And that evening, I had just gotten to bed, and the air raid sirens went off. And so I got up, got dressed, went down to the air raid shelter, and just in front of me walking in the shelter was a young lady in the British military, WAF they called them. She was in the British Army. And so as you walked in, you just kind of sat on long benches as you entered. So I sat next to her and struck up a conversation and made a date with her for the next evening. Well, we sat in there, and at that time, they weren't bombing London anymore with conventional bombs. It was the buzz bombs. The story always was, as long as you can hear them, you're okay. But when that engine stops, then they fell out of the sky. And hopefully you would hear the sound kind of disappearing and you knew it passed over you. Well, and we heard a couple of these and heard explosions off in the distance, and the all clear went. Well, the next evening when I have this date with this young lady, we were going to go to the theater, the movies. Going to meet in front of the movie house, okay? So I'm standing there, I'm looking around, and I don't see this gal that I have to have a date with. But there's a real nice-looking girl standing over there in civilian clothes that I'm noticing. Pretty soon she walks over to me and says, hello, aren't you the fellow I have a date with? Well, at this point, I don't know whether this is somebody trying to pick me up or what. So I stumble around a little bit, and she says, we met in the air raid shelter last night. Oh, I said, well, I was really looking for somebody in uniform, and you look very nice, and so on. So we went to the movies and had a nice time. But it is such a shock when you are looking at people in uniform all the time, then to see them in civilian dress, and you're not expecting that. So that was my one experience.
That's a better kind of surprise than a buzz bomb dropping out of the sky next to you. And I don't think people today have any concept, unless they live maybe in the Middle East, of what this could be like to just be around an urban setting and have these jet-propelled bombs, basically rockets, extremely inaccurate, that could fall anywhere in the city at any time. I mean, does it make you a little nervous? Are you walking on eggshells in a situation like that?
Well, you're certainly walking on eggshells when the sirens go off and you're headed for a shelter and you can hear them. Because at that point, you just don't know what's going to happen next. So really, being able to talk to somebody helps, I think, as opposed to if I was sitting there by myself. You wouldn't be sitting by yourself because there's other people. But at least I had somebody to talk to. I struck up a conversation with them. And it was, the English actually were very generous with their time for American soldiers. It was very easy to talk to them. They always wanted to know about America. Some of them even asked if we still had Indians, because we lived in the West. No, we didn't have Indians anymore. They were there, but they weren't. We weren't fighting with them. Sometimes the perception that people have is very interesting. Now, you said you wanted to ask about aircraft we worked on. Mm-hmm. Well, we had B-17s, B-24s, P-38s, P-47s, P-51, all of these that came into the European Theater of Operations, we worked on at one time or another. Mostly B-17s. We would do everything from as mundane a job as changing all the spark plugs, because after all, they had just made a very long flight across the Atlantic and want to make sure that they're ready for combat. We would change all the spark plugs. We did what was called a 100-hour inspection, which would be one of the major inspections. There was a number of other components you would change out or at least look at and inspect, see if they're working properly. Do special modifications for combat in the European theater. It was just, after a while, it just got to be very, very routine, the things you did, and we would process 6 aircraft a day in our hangar. Each shift would get their 3 done and roll those out and bring in 3 others ready for the next shift to work on, and you'd finish up the others. So it was a fairly tight schedule. We all knew what our job was, and we just got in and did it. To do the job, that was the most important thing to us. Get it done right. You didn't want to make any mistakes. Somebody's life depended on it.
You talk about modifications for combat. You're talking about bomb sights, gun mounts. What kinds of things would you do to the plane to make sure that it was prepared for what it might face on one of these bombing missions?
It depended on whether it was when we were first there or later. Air Force has a very good system of updating aircraft. As modifications were required, we would send reports back to the manufacturer that this is what we're doing and we'd like to have this done in the production line. So then eventually the aircraft would come through with those changes. No, bomb sites at that time were still very much classified, and if a bomb site was installed, there was always somebody there with a weapon protecting it. We did work on the automatic pilots. We would always check those, make sure that they were moving the control surfaces the way they were supposed to. We used different lubricants in some of the components because they were going to be flying at high altitudes and things would freeze up, so you used a much lighter component, much lighter lubricant. Some of that was in landing gear and some of the electric motors and some of those things, we used different lubricant. That sounds like an easy thing to do, but sometimes it's not. To get into that part, we always ran through all of the, at least from my part, all the electrical system, made sure everything was still working. And the radio guys did the same thing, went through. And quite often you'd find a part that was not working up to snuff and you would change it out. I can't recall for you specific other modifications that we did. We had plenty of work to keep us busy.
I imagine that not every plane was the same, and there had to be a few of those planes that the appearance of the aircraft struck you. For many different reasons, one of which would be it got shot up pretty bad. Do you ever find yourself counting the holes in any of those B-17s?
Yes, and although I've talked mostly about the new ones coming in, we always had some battle damage, war-weary aircraft sitting around. And the that sounds funny, saying just sitting around, but aircraft would come in regularly, but if we got fogged in severely, and nothing could land or take off, we would finish the new ones and then bring in the war-weary ones and work on those. So, yes, there was lots of holes in them, and generally the operating squadrons, they would put just surface patches on with pop rivets, and we generally would take those off and check to see that flak, mainly flak holes, some machine gun holes, hadn't hit a spar or something that would prevent the aircraft from being safe in violent maneuvers or in weather. So that was a lot of work. There was times when a piece of flak would hit a bundle of wires, and there'd be a temporarily wires be patched up. We'd have to go through and fix those up so that make sure they didn't short out and put generally new wiring in. So those were always special jobs. You didn't know what you're going to run into when you start taking off inspection plates and looking behind them.
Did you ever work on a plane and you're in the middle of whatever your task was that day and you thought to yourself, how in the world did this plane make it back? How in the world did somebody bring this plane in safely for a landing with all the damage that you witnessed?
No way to fly them again. They were permanently grounded. Some of them that weren't damaged too bad, they would patch them up sufficiently to get them back to major overhaul. And we had some instances where they were pretty severely damaged once we took the inspection panels off. There'd be a lot of structural work to be done to get them back up to standard specification.
I said that the appearance of the airplanes could be striking for a lot of different reasons, and one of the other reasons that comes to mind is the nose art that might have been on some of these airplanes. Did you have any favorites, or would you guys ever chuckle at some of the things that were painted on the side of those bombers?
Oh, sure, and if there was a particular enticing one, shall we say, why, the word went around the hangar pretty quick. Hey, did you see the latest one we pulled in? Fellas, hey, look at this one, you know. Yes, there was a lot of nose art, and I still have some pictures of some of those. Taking pictures during wartime was very difficult because while we were in England, we could generally get them processed. It took quite a while. But later on, when I was on the continent, there was no way to get them processed.
Well, sounds like there's more to talk about, the journey to the continent. And how about the journey home after the war? And how about what it's like to live here at the California Veterans Home in Yountville? We'll be right back with the rest of Bob Heiss's story. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you today from the California Veterans Home in Yountville. This home has been here since 1884. You can see some pictures of it online at kmjnow.com. And we're going to hear a little bit about what it's like to live in a veterans home. Of course, Fresno will be home to one of the latest California veterans homes soon enough. Visiting with Bob Heiss, 89 years old, originally from San Francisco. He was working on aircraft throughout World War II in Burton Wood, England. We've been hearing some of those stories. But you made reference, Bob, to going across the English Channel to the main continent of Europe. When did you do that and why?
Well, when the war ended, you know, we've got millions of men overseas, and they had to come up with some kind of a system, who's going to go home first. So they came up with a point system. You got so many points for just being overseas. You got so many points for being in combat. You got points for medals and other special operations. We were overseas a long time, but we were not in combat. So our turn to come home was not going to happen for another 6 or 8 months. So they selected a number of us for overseas assignment in August of, let me back up just a little bit. They selected a number of us for assignment to the Pacific because the Pacific War had not ended yet. And I was sent to a base, Preston, England, for reassignment to the Pacific. And our instructions were, look at the bulletin board each morning. If your name's on it, take your duffel bag and get on one of the trucks out there. So each morning we'd look. Well, the morning that my name appeared, I did as instructed. I went up, got on the truck. We sat there. Come lunchtime, hey, fellas, take a break, have lunch, then come back to the trucks. Okay. And then right after lunch, they said, everybody back into the mess hall. We have announcement to make. And that's when they announced the first atomic bomb had been dropped at Hiroshima. and they didn't know from at that point what was going to happen. Some of the fellows from Burton Wood who had already left, they were already on board ship. We found out later that some of them, they just turned the ships around. They were going through the Mediterranean and the Gulf, the Pacific, that direction. They just turned them around and they went home. So some of our fellows got home right away. The rest of us, we didn't know what was going to happen. Well, it was only, you know, 5-8 days later the war ended in Japan. So then they said, well, they returned home the point system. Now, you guys don't have any enough points to go home yet, so you're going to the continent. And I was assigned to a mobile repair squadron that operated, its headquarters was in Germany. Well, we went across the channel on some sort of a boat that didn't seem like it was very large. Got to a base. At that time, they were naming all the bases after cigarettes. I was at Camp Lucky Strike there for a day or so, and then we were loaded on boxcars, the same old 48 cars that they used in World War One. In French, it said right on the side of it, Chateaux and Homes, which was men and horses. Took us 3 days to get to Kessel, Germany. We got there. Here's these beautiful Luftwaffe quarters. There's two to a room, a shower. Boy, we lucked out. This is a place, wow, we don't mind staying here for another month or so if we have to. We have these quarters. So the next day, they kind of let us relax, do nothing. The day after that, they called us out for a formation for a specific assignment. I was assigned to the 36th Mobile Repair Squadron. When they would assign you something, they would say, okay, you stand over that bunch, and you fellas stay over there, and so on. An officer walked up and said, you're all with to be assigned to the 36th. We're going to get on this airplane out here. So we got on a C-47, and in 2 hours, we were back within about 30 kilometers of Paris, landed at this little airstrip. So after spending 3 days on a boxcar to get to Kessel, Germany, 2 hours, I'm back in France again, being in a mobile repair squadron. That squadron happened to be a frontline squadron of fighter aircraft, and they had only been overseas about 6 or 8 months, but they had enough points to go home because they had been in combat and so forth. And we were there 2 years, and we didn't have enough points. So that was okay. So they left, and we took over. By that time, I was the ranking NCO on this base. And the lieutenant says, well, first job, we've got to put engines on a C-47. We did that, finished. And he said, you sure they're okay? And I said, yes, sir. He said, I just put you on flying status, and you're going up with me. Are you still sure they're okay? Yes, sir. And we did. So I was on flight status, crew chief of C-47 for the last 4 or 5 months I was in the service. And we flew back to Germany a few times, pick up parts and one thing or another. Our task on that base, either destroy certain aircraft that were not going to be used in the future, or other aircraft, get them ready to move back to Germany because that base was going to close. February of 1946, I got my orders to go home. We went over on the Queen Mary. It took 4.5 days. I came home on a victory ship, the Elgin Victory. It took 14 days. Across the North Atlantic in February. Quite a different ride than on the Queen Mary in the middle of summer on a calm Atlantic. Most happy to get home. Got discharged the last day of February from Camp Beale. 6 months later, I met Betty, my wife. We married 63 years. Came here together. Unfortunately, she passed away after about a year. But I have enjoyed my time here. I'm active in probably maybe too many things. I'm on the council and on a number of committees. I think keeping active keeps a person young.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because what I'm struck by here at the California Veterans Home is if you want to be active, there's kind of no limit to what you can do around here. You can play golf. You can do all kinds of things. What do you enjoy most about being here, the opportunities that you have, and the fact that you're around a bunch of other guys who know what it's like to serve their country?
Well, yes, it is great being around a lot of other guys in the same boat you are, so to speak. Activities, we go to many museums around the area in San Francisco, Santa Rosa, Sacramento. We have the Lincoln Theater. We have performances there that We go to generally performance every week. We have the golf course for those who want to play. It's a nine-hole course, but it's very nice course. We have groups that go out for breakfast. We have groups go out for lunch. We have groups go out for dinner. We go to all the surrounding areas around here. All during the summer, the bus takes us down to Vallejo. We take the ferry from Vallejo to San Francisco for those that want to go. And they go on local shopping trips as well. It's just nothing that can't be done. As I say, I'm active on the council. And when you talk about our beautiful campus, one of my projects has been to re-identify all the trees around the Alameda. I'm in the process of putting on signs around the trees. There's about 300 different ones will have signs. Of that, there are over 100 different varieties of trees around that same area. Eventually, we'll have a little pamphlet to go with it so school children can come in and see our beautiful trees. And in the building where we're talking right now, our member service building, we have a gym. We have a bowling lane. It isn't quite open yet, but it will be shortly. We have a cafe and I was going to say the word tavern, but we're not supposed to use the word tavern. It's a social club. And we have game rooms and a beautiful library. So it's a great building, a central building for all kinds of activities.
Maybe you should call that tavern the Chapel Club.
The Chapel House. That's a thought, you know. I might put that suggestion in the box.
When you decided to come to the Veterans Home and you started telling people about that, did you get a lot of people not knowing about it, not knowing what it was, not understanding why you'd want to come to a place like this?
Absolutely. But there's a huge advantage. You're not dependent on your children for help and care in your senior years. You can live here. We have five levels of care. We've got independent living. We've got assisted living or intermediate care. We have skilled nursing care. And we have memory care. So everything is here. If you have a medical problem, we go to the clinic. They can't take care of it in the clinic. They send you to the Queen of the Valley Hospital in Napa or to the hospital in St. Helena. So the medical care is all available, our dental care, everything's right here. Everything is taken care of. You don't have to leave the campus if you don't want to.
I realize I'm chronologically out of order here, but it occurs to me that I should ask about after you got out of the service, not just how great it was to see your family again, but also all these skills that you'd been using in the military to put things together and to make sure they were safe and to make sure they were wired correctly. Did you use any of that in your civilian life after you got out of the Army Air Corps?
Yes, I did. I went back to work at McClellan Air Force Base and worked there for 37 years. I had a very good career there. I advanced from aircraft electrician mechanic into logistics management, and they sent me all over the world solving airplane problems. So it was, my career was largely based on what I started before I went in, but certainly my experience during the war was a big help, and I just continued down that path.
I know you have three children, you have three grandchildren. When you think about those generations and future generations of America who didn't live through World War II, what do you want them to understand about what happened during that time in our country and what guys like you were doing to create the opportunities we have today?
Well, to start with, one of my grandson is in the Air Force right now. One of my granddaughters is married to a Marine, and he just got back from Afghanistan. So that kind of answers part of that question. My other granddaughter is in social work, and we've talked from time to time about experience. In fact, what I did with my grandson when he went in the Air Force, instead of just writing about what the weather's like back home, I wrote letters to him telling of my experience, much like I've told you right now. In each letter, I gave him another chapter of my experience when I went through basic training, starting from the time we went to Monterey, California, and our train ride to San Antonio, and all the way through. So he has a good understanding, hopefully, of the difference between the training he received and the very short training period we had. The difference, of course, being he also got training on being an electronics technician, which I'm very proud of him about.
Do you think there's something that we can glean from the attitude of America at that time, the way people came together, how united the country was? And do you think there's anything that you witnessed or experienced there that is really important for us to remember now?
Yes, and I think you have to think about the signs that are still around some places. Rosie the Riveter, everybody went to work. Everybody did something for the war effort. There was, I think, something else that was quite different. We had been through a severe depression, and the unemployment rate was still up around 8 or 9% in 1940. And it wasn't until we started providing some things under the Lend-Lease program to Britain, when we were building aircraft in this country for them, that things started to turn around. And obviously, by December 41, when Pearl Harbor happened, things then turned around very rapidly. So there was, people were wanting to work, and there was a very, very strong nationalistic feeling at that time. I think there's one unfortunate side about that. There was certainly a lot of slurs about the Germans and the Japanese, but that's all part of propaganda, part of war. When you're attacked so severely, it makes an entirely different feeling. Now, that feeling was with us shortly after 9/11, but I don't think it's there now with the present conflict, not like it was at that time.
Well, we're out of time on the program today, but Bob, I just want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us some of those very interesting stories.
You're very welcome. I'm very happy that I could be on your program and contribute something and let people know. It was, some of it was fun and games, but some of it was pretty severe as well.
And now it's all fun and games here at the California Veterans Home in Yountville. That's Bob Heiss, 89 years old. If you want to see what he looks like, you can go to KMJNow.com or check out the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. There are some great photos there also of last week's guest, Robert Yano, who had just returned from Washington, D.C. in the Congressional Gold Medal Ceremony for Nisei Veterans of World War II. Not all Nisei veterans from the Valley were able to make it back to Washington, and I want to take a moment to tell you about an event that will honor them right here in the Valley. Mark your calendars for February 19th, 2012. We'll have our very own Valley Ceremony to present congressional gold medals to Nisei veterans or their surviving spouses. It'll be open to the public at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building on February 19th at noon. Tickets are $40. You can come honor some true heroes whose courage and commitment, I would say, is indisputable. They bled, and in some cases, they died for a country that was holding their families prisoner in internment camps. So that is February 19th, noon, at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building. For more information, call Dale Ikeda at 313-9322. That's area code 559-313-9322. Dale Ikeda. It will be a tremendous once-in-a-lifetime event, and I'll make sure to remind you about it a time or two between now and then. Another one to mark your calendar for, December 7th, the 70th anniversary of the attacks on Pearl Harbor, and one of the many events around the country will be at Fresno's VA Medical Center. That's where local Pearl Harbor survivors will come together for the final time officially as a group. Next week, another veteran that I caught up with at the California Veterans Home in Yountville, a Navy pilot who will tell us about the plane that wouldn't fly. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today and every Saturday right here on News Talk 580 KMJ.